This is Warband Radio Live.
Well, good Tuesday evening to your friends. Matt Jolly here with you. 8 o'clock out of the East Coast. And, well, it's bright and early at 4 in the morning here for the 24th of January. Glad to be with you tonight. It's a really cool thing here tonight that we're doing this evening. We're talking to the author, Stephen Bridgewater, who is, he's been in the business a long time, and he is the first and only studio guest that we've had here to our undisclosed location. Stephen, thanks for being here.
Good evening, Matt. How are you? It's nice to see you face-to-face for a change.
I know, right? You and I, we often find each other at Oshkosh or somewhere like this, and then here we are in this very odd part of the world for the two of us.
It's certainly an interesting place.
It's completely normal for everyone that lives here, but...
I can't get over the fact that, you know, you and I have worked together now for, what, 5 or 6 years on and off.
Yeah.
And invariably,
or longer
it's
than
via
that,
Skype.
Even. Yeah.
And for now, for once, I can see the whites of your eyes.
That's right.
And it's mildly scary.
It's kind of scary to be... Well, we worked together at the Arsenal Democracy.
We did. That was the last time we actually shared a studio, wasn't it?
That's right. And now you have... this is embarrassing. It's really embarrassing for me because everyone knows that I've been working on a book and maybe a second one. You have four... 1, 2, 3, 4 completed here, right in front of me.
It's been a fairly quiet year.
You're like the Louis L'Amour of warbirds. I don't know how you do this, and it's not drivel. I mean, this is good stuff.
Thank you.
And of course, we're talking about his latest books. I want to start with the pet project because this is something that you've been talking about quite a lot. And I just want to say for those of you listening tonight at home, you can get all of these on the newsstands right now. And let's. If we can get into the nitty-gritty about this. These are called bookazines.
They're called bookazines, so it's a cross between a magazine and a book. Imagine
but the
a magazine
real reason,
with a spine.
Right, but the real reason, I think, is something that people will really appreciate because we'd all rather spend our money on airplanes and flying them than doing other things like driving hairdresser cars, as you and I were discussing earlier. We'll get into that later. But these are taxed at a different rate.
There is. Books and magazines come in at a different rate. It's also, if you have a monthly magazine will stay on the shelf in Borders or Barnes & Noble or WH Smith's in the UK or whatever it is around the world for a set amount of time, finite time. You have a bookazine. It stays on the shelf until you send them something else to replace it with.
I think that's just ingenious. I really do. My hat's off to you because I think it's great.
But the other thing it's enabled us to do is actually have better quality paper. You know,
sure.
I said to you earlier, Matt, these are what we call thump factor. So if you put these down on the desk or they come right through your mailbox at home, because they've got thick paper and they've got a spine on, it feels like a really good quality product. I'm not saying a magazine isn't good quality product, but this has just got that extra bit of quality feel to it. So it looks like a magazine, but it's got a spine and it's got really nice quality glossy pages.
Well, it's wonderful work that you've been doing over there. And I want to bring this up because the Warbird Directory, this is for the United Kingdom, over 1,500 warbirds listed. It says more than 1,500 warbirds. How many, Steve?
What we've done with this is we've listed everything from World War One replicas.
Is it like 1501?
It's about 1527 from
it's
memory.
A
so it's more than 1500.
Number. It's a respectable
but
number.
But I can't honestly remember. we got into the state. Obviously, everything was in an Excel
right
spreadsheet as we were
right
creating the list.
Right.
And it was well over 1500. And then we edited a couple out. And then, of course, there's the last minute somebody says...
How do you edit them out? Are you like, well, you know, this... This is really a stretch.
It's been a real research. It's something I know you and I have spoken about for a long time. It's something I've wanted to do for years. Nobody's ever done a directory of all the warbirds
sure
in the UK. And by warbird, I know this is a bit of a catch-all, and everybody's got their own different definition of what a warbird is. We've decided, for the auspices of this book, that a warbird is an ex-military aeroplane, or it is an aeroplane wearing military markings. So it might be, for
okay
example, a J-3 Cub, but it's painted as an L-4. Therefore, it's classed in our classification as a warbird.
Or, now, here you go. Here's the caveat. The straight J-3 Cub could be the NE-1.
Exactly. That's
okay,
right.
I like that rule.
So that's
okay.
What we've done. And we got about 1,530-something aircraft in there. And then there were a few that we decided maybe we'd got in twice or we hadn't realized it had been sold overseas. And then invariably somebody comes in and says, you've missed a chipmunk in the back of a barn somewhere. So by its very nature, this is never going to be up to date because the minute this goes on sale, it changes. Aircraft are sold, aircraft are bought. Aircraft get painted in different markings. So it's, you know, I'm never going to say this is the definitive guide, but when we completed it, it's as close as we could get to the definitive guide to every warbird, be it in storage, be it under restoration, or be it flying in the UK.
Now, if I wanted to thumb through this magazine, this book of zine, as you've called it, it's more content because you have photographs of nearly all of them.
Yeah, I mean, people have done directories, people have done lists of aeroplanes, and there's some really good material out there. What we've tried to do is an illustrated guide and putting as... I could have filled twice as many pages. We had so many images, so... We've tried to focus on perhaps the sexier, more interesting aeroplanes. So the fighters, we've got pictures of that aeroplane in various markings that it's worn in the UK. So let's say, for example, let's pick one of the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight Hurricanes.
Right.
Yeah, they repaint the aeroplane every 4 or 5 years.
And so, here they are.
I mean, there we are right there. So we've got, which one have you got there? LF-363 in what, 9, 10 different markings that it's worn
through its career. Even restoration photos.
And even restoration pictures. So we've tried to do that. Obviously, when you get into chipmunks and tiger moths and Stearmans, we didn't have the space to illustrate every single one, but we've tried to put as many in as we could. We've listed every aircraft that we know of. And we've illustrated as many as possible.
It was
a real labor of love. It's something that I've wanted to do for a long time, and it seems to have hit the mark. It's selling quite well back in the UK, and I know it's on sale in the US now as well. But obviously, being just UK based aircraft, it's of limited.
Well, no, but I think that there's such
an
interest because a lot of this stuff is, as you know, in this business, a lot of this stuff. While it sees time in the UK, some of these things, they come west.
That's right.
And you just never know. And this is one of my favorite chipmunks here, which is the first one, if I believe correct.
That's correct.
Which is, I don't know what you guys would call that, but AKDN.
AKDN, I think, was it the first series production
it's
aeroplane,
the first
wasn't it?
Series.
Which has spent a couple of years in the UK now.
And it's just spectacular with the silver polish and the green pinstripe. And then, the Percival Pembroke, I was looking through here last night, and I saw one of these in a hangar in Georgia.
Oh, really?
Not far from where my airplane is sitting. And it's just sitting there. Mm. It had flown once before, and that's it. You have so many neat aircraft here that are in this book that I think folks, even if they have no desire to ever hunt these things down, they're going to find it just a great resource manual.
I think it's one thing that the UK warbird industry really has going for it is the variety of aircraft. Now, we have nowhere near the numbers that you have in the States. I think we're down to about 3 P-51s in the UK at the moment. But we've got de Havilland DH-9s from World War One. We've got 2 Gloucester Gladiators. We've got a really eclectic mix of aircraft.
And Twin Pioneers.
The Twin Pin, yeah.
What in the world is a Soko J-20?
Ah, well, they are Yugoslavian attack aircraft.
Attack aircraft?
Yeah.
What are they attacking?
What is this thing? I tell you, that thing sounds like it's got a Rolls-Royce Kestrel engine on the front. It's the noisiest aeroplane you've ever heard.
It
doesn't
reminds
go very
me of
fast,
a,
but makes a lot of noise.
It reminds me sort of a Navion, the... Soko J-20. And what else is it called? The P-2?
The P-2. Kragui.
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 Which is the Yugoslavian.
Sparrowhawk.
That's it. Yugoslavian for Sparrowhawk.
Attack airplane. So they would hang missiles and whatnot
it had gun pods underneath the wing, I believe.
It looks like a really neat aircraft. This says it's the sole airworthy example in the UK, but there are... others that are stored.
Yeah, we've got several in storage, one that's currently flying, and it's a fairly active aeroplane. You see it at quite a few events in the UK.
Now, it looks like you just gave up. You have Simon Johnston, Paul Avery, his owner, and then underneath it just says private owner.
Some people don't necessarily want people to know what they own and where it is.
But
so we've tried to respect their anonymity where possible.
I guess so, but I mean, your job as a journalist is to go knock on doors, right, Steve?
It is.
Make people angry and ask them why in the world their aircraft is painted that way
because
people
we all know
the forums,
that the scheme is not quite right.
It's not quite
That's
right.
You've got it.
I mean, this has got to be in depth. Now let's talk about hunters because there are so many gorgeous hawker hunters in the UK. I just think they're great, and you have just about
It is the epitome of if it looks right, it flies right. I think that's the Hunter just looks right. And I think it's also one of the few aeroplanes that you can convert into a two-seater. And I think it even looks better than the single-seater. You know, it's almost got that tadpole look on the front.
Oh, on the front. Yeah, yeah, I see that. I do like a Hawker Hunter. Now, something that is noticeably absent in here, picture-wise, is a Nimrod.
Yes.
Is that deliberate?
We don't have any flyable Nimrods.
Well, so it was left out.
No, Nimrod is in there. I don't think.
But there's no image.
I've run out of space, Matt. You know, what have we got? 168.
Well,
pages.
Yeah, but I mean, come on. I mean, you've got two MiG pictures. You in the Nimrod, for those of you that don't know, holds a special place in your heart.
It does. Has
the statute the statute of limitations passed on this story?
I think we can probably talk about
that
one.
Can we tell the story about Stephen's Nimrod? Because you're the only man I've ever met that has purchased a Nimrod.
Yeah, it was a long time ago, and it was.
We don't have to name names.
No,
but
it was probably my best bargain.
It was your best bargain. Do you want to tell the story or not?
Yeah, I used to.
I don't want
for
you to regret this because I'm not going to. I'm not going to edit this.
No, we're good. I used to work for an aeroplane collection. We started off life as the Air Atlantique Classic Flight. People may remember the DC-3s that we flew in the UK for many years. Air Atlantique grew into a big group of companies. Mike Collett was our founder, and he reached retirement age, decided to sell off all of his businesses and focus on collecting vintage aeroplanes. So he set up the Air Atlantique Historic Flight, which then became the Classic Aircraft and then became Airbase. And I was employed by Mike to set up the Airbase Museum for him at Coventry Airport, along with a couple of other guys, including my good friend Trevor Bailey and people like that. I got a phone call one day from a colleague who worked at Rolls-Royce who said, "Do you know that the Air Force are getting rid of the Nimrod and there's one aeroplane that's not been sold? Would you guys like one to come to Coventry?" So I went and spoke to Mike and he said, "Well, yeah, let's see what we can do. We're never going to be able to fly it.
Let's go buy a Nimrod, right?
Yeah. But we can keep it in taxiing condition. It'll be a good tribute to the guys that flew on them." So I phoned up the base commander at RAF Kinloss, got through, and said, "Yeah, we'd quite like to get a Nimrod. We'd like to fly it down to Coventry. We'd like to keep it serviceable." And he goes, "I'd love that to happen. That would be really, really good. But what you need to do is go through an organization called the Defense Disposals Agency. Now, they're tasked with getting as much money back as possible." He gave me the telephone number. I called the guys down at the Defense Disposals Agency who said, "We'd love you to have a Nimrod. But we've got to make the same amount of money selling it to you as if we sold it to the scrapmen." So I said, "Okay.
How
What's
much?
The scrap value on a Nimrod?" And this chap said, "Well, about £15,000, £15,000. So I went, "Okay." I went and had a chat with the directors and said, "What do you reckon we should do?" And Mike said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "We should make an offer." So I called back and I made an offer.
Right. You made an offer that would make some people in the markets around here blush.
Well,
I went in with a low offer,
expecting to haggle and meet somewhere in the middle. But I didn't hear anything for another 6 or 7 weeks.
Which is a long time when you're buying a Nimrod.
Which it is. I mean, I've never done this before. Yeah. Obviously,
you know, I mean, you get pretty excited when you want to buy a Nimrod, and then 6, 7 weeks go by and nothing.
The next phone call I received was from Squadron Leader Roxy Roxburgh at Kinloss saying, "Hello, Steve. We're bringing Nimrod to you on Tuesday. What time would you like it?"
It's like FedEx. They deliver.
That's
incredible.
So I said, "Well, a bit embarrassing, but we haven't actually agreed a price on this thing yet." He said, "You'd better come to lunch." So Trevor and I flew up to Scotland, up to the to RAF Kinloss.
And this is the part we should probably leave out.
Yeah, and had a big negotiation about what we should do.
Right.
And we worked on the basis that the aeroplane came down to Coventry and we took all the bits off it. And then we got an invoice in the post.
And that's exactly what happened.
And it's exactly what happened. And we got an aeroplane for substantially less than £15,000.
Right.
Full of fuel. That we managed to siphon off and kept most of the fleet flying for about a year.
Isn't that incredible?
Great stuff.
Well, and I think the Nimrod is still available to be seen up there.
It is, yeah. And it's in Grand Run. The guys at the 232, the aeroplane was called XV-232. It was a unique Nimrod, ours was, because it was the only Nimrod that was fitted out with missiles. It had the record for, it flew during the Falklands War. It flew out of...
That's what I was going to ask you to bring up, because that is a substantial piece of history.
Oh,
there.
Of course. And it was based on Ascension Island. Ascension Island was a long way from the Falklands, and it was also a long way from mainland Argentina. So what they did with XV-232 particularly was it would fly up and down just off the Argentinian coast as a sort of a show of force.
Right.
It did the longest reconnaissance mission, which I think from memory was something like 19 hours. It then landed and was retrofitted with Sidewinder missiles.
Why not?
You can imagine the guys coming back from the mission said, we ain't doing that again until you give us something that we can fire back. Mm-hmm. So ours was the only, it was jokingly called the biggest fighter in the Air Force. It was a Nimrod four-engine maritime patrol aircraft.
And it's still there
and
on
it's still
display.
At Coventry. It's in taxiing condition. The guys that look after it now do a brilliant job. And it's very much a live aeroplane.
That would be 232, I guess.
XB-232, that's
and
right.
And you have the Sidewinders on it.
We don't have the Sidewinders on it. They didn't give us the Sidewinders.
Oh, well, that'd be fun. Now, what about a Victor? To me, the Victor is one of the most iconic bombers ever from the UK. There are not any that are flying, but I noticed that Jamie Ewan has two lovely images of the Victor.
You know, I think if you were to design the Victor today, it would still look ahead of its time. It's such
it
a
really
futuristic aeroplane. You know, and that's late 40s, early 50s technology.
Now, which one of these actually? There was one of them that had a nice hop.
That was the Brunsingthorpe aeroplane. Yeah. That had a hop, gosh, probably 10 years ago now.
But it was quite a hop.
It was quite a hop. Quite a hop.
It's, for a taxi-only aircraft.
Yeah, it got airborne. I think it was a freak gust of wind or something along those lines. And the aeroplane got airborne for a good 5 or 6 seconds.
Right.
Because we've had a Vulcan flying in the UK for a number of years, retired about two, maybe 3 years ago now. Mm-hmm. I think the odds on seeing another big aeroplane like a Victor, highly unlikely. But
And why is that? I mean, you know, in
well,
the
these
US,
aeroplanes have all sat
flying.
Outside for such a long time now.
So the magnesium and whatever they've made with them.
Vulcan 558 was unique because when it was retired from the Air Force, it went straight into a hangar and it was in a protective environment. It had airframe hours on when it was retired anyway. And millions and millions and millions of pounds spent on putting that aeroplane in the air and keeping it in the air. Those Victors have all sat outside now. I think it's same as the Nimrod. It's the day that we've seen those to fly, I think, has sadly passed.
Yeah, but we will see them taxi for
you'll
a while.
You'll see them taxi. And something we do quite well in the UK now, particularly at Brunsingthorpe. When you come and see us in the UK, mate, you must come to Brunsingthorpe. It's one of Jamie's regular haunts. They run the aeroplanes down the runway there at quite high speed. A couple of English Electric Lightnings. There's three Buccaneers. We've got the Victor. There's a Nimrod there, which runs down the runway. Things like Polish Iskra jets and Fallen Gnats. And
they don't fly.
They do high-speed taxiing. And because they don't fly, you can get a lot closer to them than you can on a normal airfield. So you can... Hmm. Yeah. See, something I've always tried to do when I've worked in the museum industry, when we've got live aeroplanes, I say to people, you come in our hangar, you don't just see the aeroplanes.
Sure.
You smell them. And that's what the same applies at Brunsingthorpe. It smells like you're on an airfield from the 1950s with the Avtor wafting
across. Now, you just said something that I can already hear the hackles on some folks' necks standing up when you say a live airplane in a museum. And this is the famous line of Larry Kelly's. He said, you know, when you go to a museum and you see a stuffed lion, it's nice. It's a lion. But when you go to the zoo and you hear it roar, there's something that happens that just takes over with it. And I think it's the same with aircraft.
I think it is. I spoke earlier about Mike Collitz being the man who founded the Air Atlantique Historic Flight. He had a great phrase. He said, we're not a museum. We're a safari park of aeroplanes. Hmm. And I think that summed it up perfectly. Yes, the museums are great, and I am a big believer that certain aeroplanes need to be in museums. We need to preserve an example of everything in a museum for posterity. If it's not unique and we've got other examples around, let's fly them. Let's give people the real, especially a new generation coming
through.
We saw when the Vulcan flew, we saw kids coming through. Because the Vulcan previously flew, I think, about 1992. So there was a whole generation of kids that had come through that had never seen a Vulcan or heard a Vulcan. Then they came to the air shows and saw 558 display. And then you really see why people get excited about it.
It's a phenomenal jet. And,
it had almost like an elephant-type roar when you hit the airplane on the... They held it on the brakes at the end of the runway, and they put the throttles up to take off power. And if you've not seen it, you look it up on YouTube, guys. It was an amazing noise that you can't describe. It sounded like an elephant trumpeting. Mm-hmm. It was such a beautiful medieval sign.
Sort of it has such a shape to the wing there. Mm-hmm. That big delta.
The big delta.
What a
very graceful
machine.
Yeah,
but I would encourage you to take a look at it. Well, this book, we could go through this thing all day. Something that is unique over there in the UK is the Fallen Gnat. You love these aircraft.
I do. I've done a lot of work with the heritage aircraft guys down at North Weald, the Red Gnat display team. Through my writing, I've got to meet a lot of the guys down there who've subsequently become good friends of ours. And Oliver and Wealden is one of the leading lights of the Gnat team. They've got two flyable Gnat T1s at the moment. They've got another aeroplane being restored, and they've also got a single seat Gnat F1 which is an ex-Indian Air Force airplane.
Now, this is a tiny little airplane. For those of you back in the U.S. that are not familiar with a fallen gnat, tiny, tiny little pocket fighter that really has some idiosyncrasies that make it somewhat of a... Well, of a sportsman's airplane, shall we say?
It certainly is. It's all built around an engine. Yeah, it's the Orpheus engine. The NAS, as you say, is very, very small. So all of the pipes and the hydraulic systems, everything pretty much run inside the skin in the airplane. It's a very difficult aircraft
to
work on.
And if you lose hydraulic pressure in this airplane, the goose is cooked.
You've got the hydraulic warning lights come on, and Oliver will know certainly more than I, and I'll get him to email in and tell you, but you've got something like about 8 or 10 seconds for when the light comes on to return to straight and level flight.
Because at that point, you have to fly with the trim wheel.
And that flight, you fly with the trim wheel.
Or you bail out.
Yeah.
Which is what I would do.
Well, all the guys that fly them in the UK, they're all trained on the abbreviation is Stuprecht, which I couldn't tell you what it stands for, but
right.
they can read off to you what Stuprecht, the acronym, stands for, and that's the check you go through in those 8 or 10 seconds before you get the airplane into level flight.
Good
and
Lord.
Then you resort to flying on the trim wheel.
I think I'd just buy a Vampire. Maybe a T-33. There's so many gorgeous machines in this book that you have devoted to all 1,500-plus warbirds that are in the UK flight. To me, there is nothing more gorgeous than a Spitfire.
We have got a few Spitfires
and you
in
have
the UK.
Quite
something
a
we
few.
Do quite well.
How many do you have in the UK?
Oh, good Lord.
We could look here in the book.
I'm going to take a rough guess. I'm going to say between 20 and 25 at the moment.
Isn't that great?
But what we have got at the moment is a growing number of Hawker Hurricanes. We've seen two fly in the last year, and there's more on the way at the moment, including a two-seat Hurricane being worked on.
Wow, two-seater.
A two-seat Hurricane being worked on at Hawker Restoration.
There's a lot of people who are really hopeful now.
Exactly. Well, yeah, as I'm sure a lot of you listeners know, Matt, for many years we've not been able to fly rides in warbirds
right.
in the UK. It's a very different system to the US. So we don't have the experimental category, and we don't have the ride program that people like Collins have got. But what we have had in recent years is permission to do rides in two-seat Spitfires, and it's big, big business now. There's three or four organizations doing 30-minute flights in the back seat of a Spitfire, and we're hoping that we can grow from that moving forward. And
you know,
maybe
the Spitfire
that's where the Hurricane's
going. Such a beautiful aircraft, and when you add that other bubble to it, I don't know, it looks like a cancerous tumor or something back there. I don't know how else to describe it, but
isn't it worth it for a ride in the back?
Well, you sound like Bill Greenwood now. He goes, "I've never had anybody turn down a ride because it's so ugly." But it does. It just sort of. I don't know, it ruins the look, but I agree with you. I'm certainly glad, and I wouldn't turn one down.
There you are.
But, man, what a gorgeous machine, though.
And again, we're lucky in the UK that we've got a whole variety of Spitfires, right from the very early Mark 1s now. I think we've got three Mark 1s flying in the UK at the moment. One was exported to the US this past year, so we did have four for a while. Right through to Mark 19s with Griffin engines. We've got a Mark 14, Mark 18. Mm-hmm. So you've got the whole gamut of you know, the baby Spits, as they're called, the Mark 1, the Mark 5, through then you get the Mark 9, which was perhaps the most well-balanced. It had got the Merlin engine. But yes,
I don't know. I love the early Spits. To me, the Mark 1 is...
The Mark 1 is a pretty airplane.
It's very, very nice to look at, in my opinion. Now, what do I know, you know? Now, let's talk about the one that came here, because that is an aircraft of some significance, isn't it?
Well, there were two exported in the last year. There's 601, which went to Collins, mm-hmm. and then there was 9374, which was the Mark 1,
right.
Which went out somewhere out west. So both equally historic aeroplanes. I think 601 was at it. It's done some time over the D-Day beaches, and it's...
It was a Dunkirk Spitfire.
That's right.
I'm told.
All of these aeroplanes have remarkable history to them, and I think the fact that they're flying is so important. And doesn't matter where they're flying in the world, they're passing that story on, and they're passing that heritage down to a new generation.
And you've saved this book now for all of humanity to see. It's the Airworthy Classics and Restoration Project. It's a warbird directory over 1,500 warbirds with lots of photographs from the UK. If you're a UK listener, we have a lot of you. Go out, find it on the newsstands, and if you're a warbird lover back in the States, do it too. Now, you were talking about history. Valor in the Skies, Courage in the Skies is your other book here. It's Aviation's Victoria Cross recipients. Now, we were thumbing through this thing. I was reading several stories. But the one that stands out to me that I think everybody ought to hear, talk to us a little bit about in detail with the Handley Page that caught fire.
Well,
because this is just one example of an entire book.
I think it's about James Ward particularly. James Ward was a teenager. He was flying Wellington, or he was a radio operator on a Wellington.
A Wellington.
You probably know Wellington's fabric aeroplane, geodetic structure, so crisscross of metal covered in fabric. The aeroplane caught fire. It was hit by ground fire. It caught fire in the starboard engine. Mm. Now, young James decided he needed to put that fire out. So he managed to find some cabling, some hose, some rope. He wrapped that around his waist. He used the fire axe to cut out the side of the aeroplane. This is in the middle of flight. He got his Irvine flying jacket. He grabbed a fire extinguisher and put it down his Irvine flying jacket. And with that cable wrapped around his waist, he walked out onto the wing of the aeroplane in flight, walked to the leading edge, leant round so that he could put the nozzle of the fire extinguisher into the front of the cowling and put the fire out.
That is remarkable.
And that's 1819. He lived to tell the tale. The aeroplane got back safely. And he won the Victoria Cross, the VC, which is the highest medal of gallantry that is awarded to Royal Air Force and Commonwealth military troops.
And this is an entire collection of those stories.
This is the story of the 51 men who won the VC from 1917 through to 1946. Interesting, nobody has been awarded the VC post-1946. A Canadian Corsair pilot was the last to receive the award. Perhaps the fact that these Canadians sums it up nicely. There have been South Africans, there have been New Zealanders, Australians, Canadians. Anyone from the Commonwealth is eligible for the VC. And 51 guys have won that award over the course of the year. The criteria changed a little bit. During the First World War, I mean, Morehouse was the first to win the VC. For an act of gallantry, he dropped bombs.
Morehouse, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Flag of BE-2. As the First World War went on, people were starting to be awarded the VC just for the sheer amount of missions they'd flown. Mm. So you've got the likes of Albert Ball and people like that, who flew tens of missions against Germany and won the Victoria Cross as a result. Quite often, after they had been killed in action, it was awarded as a posthumous award. It was only in the Second World War that the award was generally given for a single act of bravery rather than for just doing lots of missions.
Well, and you think about that back then, I mean, that would have been absolutely terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, not that they all weren't, but, I mean, flying in a machine that they were flying in, much less that many times, would be terrifying to me.
And, of course, highly apt this coming year in that 2018 is the centenary at the end of the First World War, but also the centenary of the Royal Air Force. It's our centenary. RAF was formed on April the 1st, 1918, so it's going to be a very big year for us in the UK in terms
There is a young Albert Ball, right?
There is young Albert Ball. Nottingham boy, like myself.
You know, you look at his face, and what is he, 18? Mm. Maybe 19 in that image? Died just a few years probably after that image was taken. So
it's certainly concentrates the mind, doesn't it?
It really does, and this is a wonderful book, all laid out with images and lots of text that Stephen put together. And to me, the research that goes into something like this can't be just glossed over. How long did this project take?
Oh, gosh. It's difficult to say, Matt. We do it on and off, and obviously got lots of projects running at the same time. But this was, again, like the Warbird Directory, it was something I've always wanted to do. I think it was a story that needed to be told. So, gosh, months and months and months of work and several more months of condensed writing, sourcing the images. The artwork particularly, I've got a chap called Andy Hay who I work with a lot. He runs flyingart.co.uk. Mm-hmm. And Andy created all of that side view artwork for me and the front cover of Nicholson's Hurricane. Right. So it's interesting, James Nicholson, Hawker Hurricane pilot, he was the only VC winner of Fighter Command during the war. The majority of the Victoria Crosses went to Bomber Command guys. So James Nicholson, who appears on the front cover of our Valor in the Air book, is the only, not only the only Hurricane VC winner, but the only Fighter Command VC winner.
I love it here. He simply pulled his flying suit over his pajamas.
And different
the rest,
times.
And the rest is history, as they say.
Different days.
This is a great book, and I would encourage anybody to run out and get it. And the price on this, I mean, I don't know how you do it. Again, we were talking earlier, this is $6.99.
UK. That's right.
I mean, that's nothing for one of these guys to pull this up and read. I couldn't remember how much I was going to look at the Warbird Directory. $7.99 UK.
Well,
there you go.
They're all produced by Key Publishing and the same people that produce a lot of magazines in the UK. So I guess we have economies of scale. We can get things printed more cheaply than the independent publishers.
Well, they're wonderful documents of history there. And, of course, the Warbird Directory. And then the other one we've just been talking about, Valor in the Air, Courage in the Skies, a collection of all of the Victoria Cross recipients throughout history, which has been well researched by our guest today, Stephen Bridgewater. Stephen, what are you digging around in right now that really has you excited? Because you and I haven't talked about this yet, but I'm just curious. You're always working on something. You always have some big project that you're working
on. I just finished the latest bookazine just before we flew out to see you. And that is on the history of the MiG company. So I've gone to the Russian side of things. So we've traced Mikhail Anangarovich from how they met, working for in the Polikarpov Design Bureau in the late 30s through to creating the first MiG-1 in late 39, early 40, through the early jets, right the way through to the current jets.
I don't think
jets.
People realize that MiG actually worked for Polikarpov.
That's right. I mean, everybody,
that's where
MiG,
he started, yeah.
People think MiG, MiG-15, and then coming right. through to MiG-21, and the airplanes were all familiar, the pointy jets. Mikhail and Gurevich were both designers employed by Nikolai Polikarpov, and you may know the Polikarpov fighters. There's a bit of few in the US now. The Polikarpov right. I-16 looks a little bit like a GB racer.
Oh, sure.
There was a biplane version of that, the I-153. And the first job that Mikhail received when he was employed by Polikarpov was to go and make the thing work, because it had been through all of its acceptance trials, but every time they fired the guns, the engine stopped. And
well, there it
was
blew the prop apart.
There was all sorts of issues, and he was such a gifted designer that right. he got this aeroplane into service and got it into service really quickly. And the powers that be in the state of Russia decided that this guy knew what he was doing.
And they made him an aircraft designer.
So he got his own design bureau, teamed up with Gurevich, who he'd met at Polikarpov. He was actually his supervisor at Polikarpov. So the two went on and created perhaps one of the most famous design bureaus, certainly in Russia, if not the world.
I would agree with that. I mean, they went on to do some wonderful things. Now, you look at the early MiG, especially like the 15 and maybe even the 17 to some standard. You park it next to an F-86. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at that because there's a Korean War book that you finished over here, mm-hmm. The aircraft, the people, the valor. But it's two aircraft at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And the MiG has that gigantic oxen tow bar hole in the nose of it still. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of sets your mind where the two countries were.
That's right.
During that time. I mean, they used what they had, and they did what they had with very well, I mean, in my opinion.
They used what they had, and they both did very well. But, of course, a lot of it came from German research. At the end of the war in 1945, a lot of the German research went left. A lot of it went right, mm-hmm. east and west.
Yeah.
And that's where that swept wing technology came from. That was Messerschmitt technology, which had been captured and taken across to North America and the other guys in the U.S. And Mikhail Anangarovich seized the opportunity with that as well. So,
and so from a Brit's perspective on this, you can sort of stay neutral more or less and dig out some really great stories.
That's what we've tried to do. We've tried not to be led by propaganda and hearsay and actually look at the true story behind it. And, some of those early MiGs were really flawed aeroplanes. But, there were a few American aeroplanes that weren't great from the get-go either.
Oh, hands down, absolutely. But yeah. I think it's such a... the reason I bring that up is because when you see the two side by side, you really get the feeling of where both nations were at
yes.
at that time. And you go, wow, this is impressive technology from where it came from mm-hmm. in both respects.
That's right.
So I think it's a great book, and I'm looking forward to seeing that one.
We touched on the
MiG-9. You didn't bring that
well.
One in the...
Well, that literally went to print the day I jumped on the aeroplane. We signed the pages off and
the other
went down
to
Heathrow. But we touched on the MiG-9 as well, which is an aeroplane that very few people know about, the straight-wing MiG-9, the first Russian jet. And the thing which I never realized until I researched this is that Yak were working on their aeroplane as well, Yakovlev, mm-hmm. Mika, and they both got the aeroplanes ready. They both turned up at the airfield with their aeroplanes on the same day. Well, who's going to have the honor of being the first Soviet jet pilot?
Right.
The test pilots flipped a coin. I tell you what.
You flipped the coin.
You flipped the coin. And Mikhail went first, and then MiG-9 was the first Russian jet. But for the flip of a coin, it could easily have been the Yakovlev.
You never know.
That's how history changes.
The other one you have here is the British Phantoms collection, which is great. And then let's talk about the Korean War, because this is a nice one. Corsairs, looks like some... some other good stuff there on the front. I don't have my glasses on.
Sea Fury.
Sea Fury down there.
Yeah, so we've covered all of the air arms that were involved in the Korean War, as we call the air war over the 38th parallel. This was actually written by a chap called Phil Chinnery, who's written several books on both Vietnam and Korea. I edited it and got it into the position where we are now. It was really interesting again.
You're the only man I know that has an interest in Korea far beyond that of others. You actually have post.
Yes.
From Korea. I'm going to leave it at that.
We have a very good friend who travels the world. Right. She's a young lady, travels the world on her own. She's a doctor in the UK. And earlier part of 2017, we got a postcard from North Korea. She'd been on vacation to North Korea and sent us this most amazing postcard.
It is an amazing postcard. I've only seen photos of it, but it looks exactly like what you'd think it was going to look like.
It is. Like, it's real gung-ho, isn't it?
It is. It is real gung-ho. That's a good word for it. But I love it. I think that's terrific. The Korean War, it's still not over, technically.
No, that's right. Yep.
We could be back with F-35s. You never know.
You never know.
But this is a neat book. So quite a little bit of work, Stephen. I mean, I don't know. You could have maybe done three or four more.
It's been a quiet year.
A quiet year.
I've had a lot
year.
On my plate this year. So we've just done
year
four.
In the Abbey.
I don't know what we're working on next. We haven't got any set plans at the moment. We've got, obviously, with the centenary of the Royal Air Force, I suspect we'll be doing several RAF-themed bookazines over the coming year, but we might throw something else in just to throw the mix up.
The reason I keep going back to this is I think that when you see these things in Barnes & Noble, wherever you're at, wherever you're going out to the bookstore, pay attention, because if you see any of these, the Warbird Directory, Valor in the Air, Courage in the Skies, the British Phantoms book, pick it up, because it's not what you think it is. I'm telling you, these are chock full of great stories that no matter where you live, if you're an aviation fan, you're going to find these interesting. And quite frankly, you would pay a lot more if this thing had a hardback cover on it than you would.
That's right.
And it's sort of this sneaky little round. I think that's the best part. It's very clever.
And the other thing, we've also got images in here which have hardly ever been seen. We're part of Key Publishing. About 4 years ago, Key Publishing bought the Aeroplane Monthly Archive. And Aeroplane magazine goes back to about 1911. And the majority of the early part of the photo archive is on glass plate negatives. A lot of those have never been
out.
They've never been published. So when we, particularly for Valor in the Sky, when we needed pictures of a Handley Page Hampton or something like that, rather than using the pictures which everybody's seen, I've gone back into the archive and found images which I'm fairly sure, if they were seen in 1939, it's possible, but the photographer would have gone along to, he would have been invited to, let's say Royal Air Force Bicester to go and see the new Blenheim Mark I when it was joined the service. He would have taken three rolls of film on glass plate negatives. Two of those images may have appeared in Flight or in Aeroplane of the Day. The rest have never been published. So what I've tried to do with these is have an avenue that we can actually get these images out into the 21st century and get people to see them.
That's remarkable there. And you're doing such great work. Let's go back to the director, because I wanted to ask you what you're excited about coming down the line in restoration. What do you have your eyes on?
It's going to be a big year.
Because you are an international award-winning aviation photographer.
Thank you.
As I was corrected the other night.
Not by me, I have to say. It was my wife who corrected you on that.
Dr. Jones corrected me. But you're an international award-winning photographer. Tell everybody the award, because it's a big one.
This
was 2 years ago.
This was 2 years ago. I was shortlisted last year and won it the year before. It's the Aerospace Media Awards. It used to be called the International Aerospace Journalists of the Year.
Big deal, you know. Big deal, big black tie affair, and there's your image.
My winning image was the Red Arrows doing their synchro cross.
Right.
It was one of those.
It was a nice one.
Tried to take the photographs for years, and it suddenly came right on the day.
Right.
It was taken at Duxford, actually, the Imperial War Museum at Duxford, one of their air shows.
You've got to be excited about something, because as a photographer, you want to get out there and see it. As a journalist, tell the story.
The airplane I'm most excited about seeing this coming year is the DH-9.
Okay.
Guy Black, Era Vintage, been restoring for a long time, an original de Havilland DH-9, First World War bomber. This airplane flew with the Royal Air Force, was sold after the Air Force to India. Or donated, if you'd like, to India, and disappeared off the radar.
And now it's back.
Guy Black, 20, 25 years ago, heard reports that there might be a DH-9 somewhere. So went out to India with some colleagues. Started looking around, went to one of the Maharaja's palaces, and there in the elephant stables underneath the palace were two DH-9s. No
engines.
Are
there pictures in this?
Possibly not, because I don't think it's actually been completed when we published that. But if you look at DH-9, it's a seriously big single-engined aeroplane. Armstrong Siddeley Puma engine. There were no Puma engines with the aircraft when they were found in India.
The Maharaj had his elephant stable.
Luckily, you imagine how many of these aircraft were lost over the years. They were probably stripped down to wood, used as fence posts or whatever. These two survived. A guy restored one as a static exhibit for the Imperial War Museum. You can see it at Duxford in the big airspace hangar. And he's restored one to fly. It's now at Duxford. It arrived there later last year. And it's assembled and it's ready. Assuming we're just waiting on paperwork and good weather now to go. But guy found a Puma engine in Canada. Lots of complex swaps of exhibits so that he
could
get
the
Puma.
This is like Tom Riley's XP-82. I mean, it just came from all over the world.
That's right.
You're talking about stuff that's over 100 years old. I mean, that really becomes challenging to locate.
Yep, that's right. And if you see the workmanship that Aero Vintage and Guy's team have put into this aeroplane, the correct tools have been used, the correct fabric has been used. It's an authentic restoration as the aeroplane would have come out of the factory in 1980.
How will it be painted? Because everyone's going to want to know.
It's painted in its original markings. It's painted now. It's good to go. So it's in the olive drab khaki scheme. Very simple scheme, but stylish. It's got no garish art on it for the sake of it. It is as it would have appeared.
Doesn't have a shark's nose.
No, there's no shark's mouth.
Invasion.
No, there's no D-Day
stripes.
It isn't. Guy is a real stickler for detail.
You have the same pet peeves over in the UK.
Absolutely,
you
got
US.
It. But Guy is the same man who restored the Hawker Fury to fly. He restored two Hawker Nimrods. He's got a real attention to detail. He's an engineer. That guy's thing is it has to run properly. Yeah, it's not to look like a DH-9. It has to be a DH-9 with the proper engine, and it's got to be absolutely spot on. So that's the airplane I think I'm perhaps most excited about this coming year.
We're in the area of Southwest Asia. We're sitting down. We're talking about airplanes that are under restoration. You don't have to say it. But do you thumbs up or thumbs down? Just for me, the P-40. Okay.
Enough said.
We won't go into that then. That's a fresh wound.
Yeah.
In the UK.
It's a terrible shame.
I'm not going to say anything about it because, I don't want anyone to point blame. But everyone knows what we're talking about right now because they're very adept at reading between the virtual radio lines here. But but I've heard. Are we just hanging? Are we grasping at straws? Have you heard the rumors that I've heard that maybe it was gotten out of there, and this is something else that we don't know about?
I don't know. I think it seems too much of a coincidence to me.
You think it's the real deal?
It certainly appears to be from what I've seen.
You don't think it was smuggled out?
If so, where did that airframe come from that we didn't know about? So it will be
always
nice.
Always one with the logic, Steve. I mean, here we are. We tried to have the great shows about Amelia Earhart disappearing and the lost TBM squadron. Every time we do this, someone brings up logic like you. They won't fan. We just for once.
Is it always the logical Brit that comes down and shoots your ideas down?
Can't fan the flames of controversy even a little bit on this station. Steve's aware. Where would the other one come from? I don't know. They found one out there. I mean, why couldn't they find another
more
one?
Out there in the sand.
I'm telling you. That was Mike Porter's advice to me before I left for this adventure, this sojourn. He said, find another P-40.
We looked the other day. We couldn't see any.
We haven't seen one yet, but who's to say? Who's to say? All right, good fun. Four magazines is what they look like, but they're not.
They're bookazines,
and they are chock full of information that you're going to want to see and read. So get out there and buy Steve's books because then he gets to write more. And how many for next year? You going for six?
I'm going to aim for six this coming year. It's a little bit of a quieter year. Hopefully less travel and more time in front of the computer.
Well, it's going to be good stuff. Stephen Bridgewater, he is the prolific author of the UK and the aviation scene, and he's always fun to have
on
the show.
Matt, we didn't speak about hairdressers' cars. I just wanted to pick you up.
All right,
you did tell the listeners that you would speak.
Here's the deal. I think I need a... I used to drive a British card. I have got the British, quasi-British airplane, right? I mean, I have
a chipmunk.
I have a chipmunk, but I mean, any proper Brit would look at my chipmunk and say, well, it's a Canadian chipmunk. Mm. That's cute.
Mm-hmm.
Bubble canopy, real men flying greenhouses.
We're still not talking hairdressers, Cass.
I'm getting there. I'm getting there. And I told Steve that I'm thinking, you know, I'd like another MG. I used to have an MG, and it was fun to go to the airport and whatnot and drive to work. And I told him I'd like another MG, but I'm leaning towards a Miata, an old one, because they're less money, and I can buy more book of zines and all of this stuff. And Steve says, without any hair atop his own head, Matt...
They do have a bit of a reputation in the UK for being hairdressers' cars.
Which I was not aware of. I had no idea. And then you say, even worse, you remember the man that was in the movie Bruno? And I sort of nodded. I think I watched 30 seconds of that movie before I realized it wasn't for
me. Bruno would drive an MX-5.
See, there's just no love from you, is there?
I'm sorry, my friend.
Saving me from hairdressers.
We've enjoyed your hospitality.
Yeah.
I shall see myself out the door.
Yeah, you should. All right, Stephen Bridgewater, the United Kingdom Warbird Directory. It's on sale right now. More than 1,500 Warbirds from the UK. Valor in the Air, Courage in the Skies, a wonderful book about the Victoria Cross. And then British Phantoms, plus the Korean War. They're all under the Key publishing name and moniker, so look for them wherever books are sold. Thanks for listening. So long for now, everybody. Be sure and thank a veteran if you see one, and we'll talk to you next week. Good night.